one of my favorite friends. And your name was, Kim. Kim from Chula Vista. Come on up here, Kim.
I was joking that you were looking for my name.
Hi. My name's Kim. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so happy to be here tonight. In fact, I will say that I would rather not be any place in the world than in an AA meeting in Chula Vista on Saturday, the Saturday before Christmas. I'm stoked to be sober. If you are new, here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to know I am stoked to be sober. And I am not fighting wanting to drink. Today was not a treacherous day to get through without a drink. I'm in a position of drinking is actually not on my mind at all. This is something that I did not know would happen to me. So John and I, the speaker coordinator, I want to thank the speaker. I got this gig because I slept with the speaker coordinator. That's why I'm here. He's right here. My husband, John, is a speaker coordinator. And I haven't spoken here for a few years, so we were going over dates and decided tonight, because it's the Saturday before Christmas and a lot of people are gone. People don't want to speak at this time of year because a meeting can be also dead. People are, you know, traveling, have family, and as evidenced by how sparse it is here tonight. And then a few days ago, I realized when I looked at the calendar that it's December 21st, which my sponsor, Maureen, who sponsored me for 31 years, who died 2 years ago, this is her AA birthday. And so she would have been 51. She died with 48 years sober. And so I told John, yeah, must be meant to be. And I hope to talk about her. You know, she's up at the big meeting in the sky and they're doing everything right. They're only reading conference approved literature and everyone's only identifying as an alcoholic. And it's heavenly in the meetings up there. But since she's died, I usually touch on the fact that I had this sponsor for 31 years and she died. And then if you've ever been in grief, this is what happens to me. I'm afraid I'm going to fall into a deep well of sadness that I won't be able to climb out of, and I won't be able to regain my composure. And I hope that I can talk about her a little bit tonight, because she was one of the most important people in my life. Maybe the most important person in my life. So I will start off by saying I do have a sponsor. Currently, my sponsor's name is Marty. She's been my sponsor for 2 years. Why? Because my sponsor died 2 years ago. And if you are not sponsored, or you're needing to change sponsors, or maybe your sponsor's moved, or maybe your sponsor's gotten drunk, or whatever, maybe it's just not working out. And I do believe that although sponsor-sponsee relationships can be a wonderful, wonderful connected thing, it's not a till death do we part relationship. There's no obligation. You can change sponsors. So if you're feeling nervous about that, about having to ask someone, I just went through it again a couple years ago. I hadn't done that for 31 years. And you know what? It sucked. It absolutely sucked. My sponsor died on September 11th. It was a Sunday. And the Tuesday after, I called a woman that I kind of know on the peripheral of AA and someone that I really have always admired. And I said, my sponsor died 2 days ago. I need someone to sponsor me. Will you do it? And she said, yes. And she had a long-term sponsor that died, and she said, I want you to call me every day. The ground has been just completely shook underneath you, and just call me every day. Let's kind of get grounded here. And she was wonderful, and it was this perfect transition, but a few weeks into it, I was like, this is not a good match. This isn't a good match. We weren't going to mesh with each other. And so I had to do that whole uncomfortable thing of saying, thank you. Thank you for getting me through this time. I'm going to need to get another sponsor. So I know what that's like again, and it's hard. But I don't screw with the recipe of Alcoholics Anonymous at all. That means I sponsor women. That means I am in the steps, which in my daily life, that looks like 10, 11, and 12, really active. I go to meetings. I'm of service. I have a God that I'm connected with, and I have a sponsor. Those things don't change for me. So even though no one could match up to Maureen, I didn't want to get another sponsor. I did it anyways. I am a result of a loving God, the 12 steps of AA, and really strong sponsorship. That's why I stand here before you today saying I'm stoked to be sober and I'm not thinking about drinking or not drinking. So Marty's been my sponsor for a couple years. Welcome to Isaac. And Nikki, it's good that you're here too. Welcome on your visit from Guam. There is a little stack of court cards over here, so I have a feeling there's more new people than just Isaac. And so if there is anyone that did not want to identify, welcome. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to identify. I carried a court card until I was like a year sober. I begged my probation officer to stop making me take this humiliating thing to meetings because I wanted to be sober. I was like an active member of AA now. And, you know, he basically told me, I don't believe you and this is your proof. I didn't know then that you can just Google the schedule, write in a meeting and make up a name. We're anonymous here. If somebody comes asking if, you know, if Joe Blow, because he's on parole, went to our meeting, we're going to cover for you. So you can write your own court card. Okay, where was I? My sobriety date. My sobriety date is October 12th, 1989. It's a long time. I celebrated 35 years this last October. No clapping. Super grateful. And I'll tell you about my last drink in just a couple minutes, which was on October 11th, 1989. I have a home group, and my home group is here on Wednesday nights. It's the No Matter What Women's Group. There are women here that go to that meeting. And any of you ladies that don't, if you are looking for a great meeting, Wednesday nights here at 7 o'clock. John and I moved here in 2001, and we immediately set out to find out where our AA peeps were. And in 2002, I came to this women's meeting here. And I love my home group. And if you don't know what a home group is, a home group is like your home. So I'm here on Wednesday nights unless I'm sick, out of town, or dead. If I'm dead, I'm not going to show up. And I love our group. My home group, we do a lot of stuff. Happy birthday, Laura. We camp every year. Laura goes camping. We run a big workshop every March that is it's called Women Sponsoring Women. Ladies, mark your calendars. It's going to be March 15th. We're planning for it. We've been doing that for years. It's an all-day event. We take a lot of, pride into that. It's a free all-day event where we have speakers and panels, and it's fabulous. And I always have a commitment at that that workshop. So my home group, I have to say this just because I'm looking at this cutout of Mary. My home group is like a bunch of bad girls gone good. And our elder statesman is Mary, who has 50 years, which if you can't see this cutout, come look at it after. Because she's wearing a shirt that says recovering slut on it. So that's what our long timer looks like at my home group. I'm happy to be sober. I'll tell you about my first drink. Oh, and let me tell you one other thing. If you are new, it is the holiday season. It's not always going to be this hard. I promise you it's not always going to be this hard. But there is a reason we have Elkathons. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. The Bermuda Triangle for alcoholics, right? There are 24-hour meetings here because the holidays can be really difficult. If you're like me, the idea of not drinking on New Year's Eve is absurd. And maybe the idea of not drinking or having to face your family, or maybe you're estranged from your family, or maybe a family that you wish you were estranged from, but you're not. And you can come to the Elkathon and be with us alcoholics. It can be a difficult time of the year. Okay, my first drink is ingrained in my brain because it's one of the most important days of my life. I was 11 years old. This was not my first drink. This was my first drunk. I was 11 years old. My big sister was babysitting me because my parents were off doing their thing. I had very loving parents, but my parents were very hands-off and into living their own life. And they gave us a lot of rope to hang ourselves, and hang ourselves we did. So my big sister was babysitting me while my parents were out of town, and was drinking rum and Coke. And I've had two older sisters and two older brothers, and they were not concerned about, you know, taking care of Kim and not letting her get exposed to pot or alcohol at a young age. They were cool, right? So she let me drink rum and Coke. And by the end of that night, I was drinking rum out of the bottle. My sister had a tricked out Camaro. It was in the days where you used to paint your sports cars. I can't remember if she got painted red or black, but she had the upholstery redone. It was houndstooth. I barfed all over that car that night. So, and we were at my parents' house because my parents had a lot of alcohol. I still lived there. My sister was married and lived in her own place, but she came to babysit me at my parents' house because they had a lot of alcohol. We had one room in the house that was the bar room, which was a bar, fully stocked bar. There was a beer fridge, you know, on the outside, and there was a fully stocked bar in the kitchen. So she wanted free booze that night. So we went over to my parents, and then that night we drove back. She was babysitting me, and I stayed at her house. And I woke up in the morning naked on her bathroom floor because I'd been sick all night. And a couple things I can tell you. Number one, I could not wait to do that again. ASAP stat. And you know what? I could literally jump to the day that to the days right leading up to my getting sober and tell you that that's what my drinking looks like pretty much then. It's almost guaranteed that I am going to be drinking out of a bottle. I will black out. Maybe I'll barf, but I will ruin your stuff as well. So that is, and you know, it's funny. There's a lot of things I don't remember. I cannot recite what my wedding day really looked like, but I know that first drunk and how great that was. And like I said, the details of that night. I blacked out. I am a blackout drinker. I have never drank and not blacked out. So I don't have, you know, my drinking, I have lots of flashes of things, but I've never been able to recall a whole evening or day where I was drinking. I'm just a blackout drinker. I don't know why. People might want to, you know, go through the minutiae of my family tree and see all the alcoholics and maybe think that there's something to that. I don't know. I just know that when I drink, I like the effect produced by alcohol. As the book says, I like the effect produced by alcohol. Isn't it nuts that some people don't like the effect produced by alcohol? Some of them, it scares them or makes them nervous. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I like the effect produced by drugs. I would, if I could get away with not talking about drugs, I would. However, I'm going to get to a part in my story where I move in with my drug dealer. So it's going to become a little evident there that I am not just a straight alcoholic. So I didn't set off and become a, you know, I wasn't a street urchin at 12 drinking because I lived at home with my parents. But alcohol was very accessible to me. And like I said, I have these older siblings who are smoking pot, drinking. My sisters got stuck babysitting me a lot. Like I said, my parents were kind of having a good time living their life, right? When I was 14 years old, something really magical started to happen for me. And I started high school. And my husband talks about that if he could freeze a moment in time where everything is working and great with alcohol, like if we could only freeze it right there, it would have been when I was 14. I started high school and a whole new world opened up to me. So I was raised in Oxnard, California, which is in Ventura County. And I had a pretty good childhood. And so I get into high school, and now I'm exposed to a lot of different people, and everyone is getting high together. I mean, we had this whole punk scene going on in Nardcore, so there were all these guys in bands. And, you know, then you had the chick who dressed like Pat Benatar every day of her life. And then you had the goths. And then you had the long-haired Hessians. And everyone was getting high together. It was great. Like I said, a whole new world. And a couple really important things happened. The first is that at 14 years old, I started to get some consequences for my drinking. Started to happen a lot and fast. Here's an example. This is actually a funny story. So I had made fast friends with the football team at my high school. And so they were, I was a latchkey kid. My parents worked all the time. You know, I was home alone a lot. So we skip school and go to my house to get stoned. So we're in the garage, in the kitchen. Everybody's, you know, getting stoned. And I think I hear the garage door, which it's the middle of the day. Nobody should be coming home. But I open the garage door, and sure enough, there is the garage door rising. And it's my dad. And he could be a very frightening figure. So I scream at everyone in the kitchen, "My dad's here, run!" So everyone runs, I run, we run out the backyard, jump the fence, and I stay gone for a couple days because I know my dad is going to beat the hell out of me. So a couple days later, I call and do the responsible thing, and I call my mom to check in, and I say, "I'm fine, just want to let you know I'm a little scared to go home." And my mom says, "Your dad broke his leg chasing you guys out the backyard." Yeah. So then I said, "I am not coming home." So yeah, my dad broke his leg chasing us and all these dudes, right? His little baby daughter and all these guys out of his house. So I stay gone for a couple weeks. And it's so funny because there are some stories in my family that are funny. That one is never a funny one. That one is always like, "Oh, remember the time dad broke his leg because of Kim?" And everyone's real solemn about it, you know? And I'm like, "I'm sorry, make amends again." The other really instrumental thing that happened there is that I met this man who was my drug dealer, who I would end up shortly moving in with. We hit it off really well, actually. So he was not at my high school. He was older. But I got introduced to him, and I started getting loaded with him and this little crowd that lived in the Wagon Wheel Trailer Park in Oxnard. Does anyone know this? Anyone from Oxnard or know Wagon Wheel? Yeah, you're from Piru, right, John? Yes, so it's all condos now, urban sprawl. But in Oxnard, there was this area called Wagon Wheel, and they had like this big neon sign with a wagon, you know, like a wagon. And they had a bowling alley, they had a trailer park, they had a motel, they had an ice skating rink. It was pretty seedy. And that is where this guy lived. And so I moved on in to the trailer with him. And it was kind of like a flop house. I mean, there were different people there. So, you know, some people kind of lived there for a short amount of time, short, you know, spurts. And we fought a lot. I spent a lot of nights in that 24-hour bowling alley wondering where I was going to go, who I was going to call, what I was going to do. The book says, so the doctor's opinion says to the alcoholic, their life seems the only normal one. How I started to living in this trailer with my drug dealer and a bunch of other dudes, and just getting loaded 24/7, that seemed normal to me. Everyone I was around in my circle was doing the same thing. I didn't have any real desire. Like, I didn't think I was going to grow up and go to college. I did have visions of marrying a very rich person, the rich man that could take care of me, but that was about the extent of my dreams. I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything or ruining my life. It was the only normal life, and I like to be loaded. I like to be loaded 24/7. I like to be comatose, or as close to comatose as possible. I like to be laid out on the floor, unaware of what is going on around me. I'm not one of those people that feels taller, prettier. I just like to not feel. I can't tell you why. There's nothing that terrible that happened to me as a child. I don't know why I want to be out of reality so bad, but I like to be out of reality. And I don't need to go to a party. You don't need to take me anywhere. I spend a lot of time in bathrooms, and that is cool for me. I lived in this trailer park, and what started to happen is if I did go out, I would get arrested. Every time I walked out the door, I have been arrested for a drunk in public. I have been arrested for petty theft. I have been arrested for breaking and entering. I have been arrested twice for public indecency because I happened to be naked when they were arresting me out in public. I have been arrested as a minor in possession. I mean, on and on and on and on. You know, I said I was on probation, got the court card. At 15 years old, there was a pilot program implemented in Ventura County that was, it was like alcohol school for teenagers. And I was in that pilot program because it was for juvenile offenders that had lots of alcohol offenses. And I had a lot of alcohol offenses. And I didn't drink during those classes, but I smoked pot every time before class. With all the other attendees, we would meet early and get stoned. I smoked pot all day, every day. To me, pot was the same as cigarettes. It's like not even a drug, right? That's just like the buffer. So I get it when people get into AA and have a hard time with the pot thing. You know, is this a drug? Is it not a drug? It's from the earth. It's a drug. It's a drug. We don't do it here if we want to be sober. We don't do any of that. I take my sobriety super serious. I mean, Bill's story, he says that to some people, how does he put it? He says to some people, we may be seemingly worldly and have levity, meaning we make a lot of jokes about, you know, that time I almost died. But that underneath that is a deadly earnestness. I have a deadly earnestness about my sobriety. What that means for me is that I'm really careful about what I put in my body. This is totally personal. This is just me. I don't take any medicine that says nighttime on it. I don't take any medicine that has a bunch of Z's on it. There's a lot of foods I don't eat either. You know, I don't eat shrimp scampi. I don't eat tiramisu. I mean, there's stuff I don't eat because it's made with alcohol. And I've had people say, oh, you know, why are you so strict, or it burns off? I mean, we heard a chef who said, I think it takes actually like 8 to 10 hours. But the reality is, you do you with your sobriety. I don't want that. I don't want that in my body. I don't want to tempt fate. And I like the idea that I am completely clean and sober. There is no doubt for me. No doubt. So I'm strict as shit when it comes about my physical sobriety. And we have a dry house. I think we've had alcohol in our house maybe twice. My daughter graduated college, and I didn't know what to buy. I bought 2 cases of Corona, and all these people nowadays that are not alcoholic, there was 12 left, and there was like 50 people at our house. I mean, they only drank 12. We were like, what are we going to do with these Coronas? I mean, this is ludicrous. Everyone's like, I'm driving tonight. I mean, yeah. Okay, so where am I at? I'm going to still talk. Okay, so my drinking, yes. I'm here's another thing. I'm a prolific hitchhiker. This is in the days where you hitchhiked, remember? Everybody was hitchhiking. I'd get out there, stick my thumb out, and find somebody to party with, because that's who picks you up. So at times, you know, I'm hooking up with all these different people. I mean, me and my girlfriend one time hitchhiked, and we met up with these guys who had this, like, real weird carpet business in Pasadena, and we went and hooked up with them and stayed at their, in this industrial area that was gated and locked. One of these guys was like in love with my girlfriend, and they had a lot of drugs, and I thought, maybe this will work out for us. But after about 3 days, they kicked us out. Here's the kind of person I am when I'm drinking using. You meet me and it's all fun. It's like, you're a crazy bitch. I want to get high with you. And I'm like, all right, let's get high. And then 3 days later, you're like, you are a crazy bitch. Get out of my car. Get out of my house. Get out of my life. I wear out my welcome real quick. That's the truth. So in 1986, I have a really bad day. I'm fighting with this guy that is also kind of staying in this trailer that I'm living with in my drug dealer. We're in a physical altercation, and I'm losing this fight, and he's kicking the hell out of me. And I'm seeing sort of my life kind of flash before my eyes, you know, like, I can't live like this. This is disgusting. I'm disgusting. I hate myself. I'd rather be dead. I hate everyone that's around me. But I can't put two and two together that it's the alcohol. I don't realize that. So I put on some clothes really quick and I run out. And I run to the payphone. Who is it? Does everyone know what a payphone is? I collect call my mother. Remember collect calls on the payphone? Yes, remember how you would call and the operator would connect you and you'd have that second where she'd have both of you connected and you'd have that second to scream at the person and beg them to take your collect call. Please, I'm in trouble, take my call. So I collect call my mother and I tell her, I can't live like this, pick me up. I'm at the Wagamo Bowling Alley, will you please come get me? She comes and gets me. I'll tell you what I look like on this day. I'm wearing a mini skirt. That's how I dressed all the time. Super short mini skirt, barefoot. I have no shoes. I don't know where my shoes are. And a men's shirt. And I hop into the car. I must have been a sight to see on that day. And I tell her what I have said before, which I really meant, actually, as much as I could mean, which is that I want to get my shit together. Can I come home? Can I come home? I want to get my shit together. I'll do anything. And she says, yes. My family is pretty much split. We've got half of us are just stone cold drunks. And the other half are codependents. But the other half that are codependents aren't like those real, they're not at church and they're not real like, you know, they're not real stuffy codependents. They're loose themselves. But they are codependent and take care of us alcoholics. There's a whole bunch of us that have been supported emotionally, financially, by my family members. I just realized something I forgot to say. But let me finish this story. And then remind me to talk about Sutton. So I go home, and my plan is I'm just going to live at my parents' house and not tell anybody I'm here and just stay in here and figure out what to do. And I won't drink or do any drugs or let anyone know that I'm alive. Won't let anybody find me. Because back in that day, there was no social media or cell phones. Like if somebody wanted to find you, they had to call you on your landline or come to your house. So if they came to somebody comes to your house, you just answer your door. They can't find your location on their cell phone. So I just thought I would hide out, lay low, try to get it together. And so I sleep for 3 days. Which I really needed, and on that third day, my mom says, I want to take you to see a therapist. I'm game. I've seen therapists before. I like people listening to my hardship, so I'm into it, right? I get driven to Glendale and dropped off at a rehab, and this was a shock. I didn't know anyone that was sober. I didn't know what rehab was. I've never heard the word alcoholism or alcoholic. And I'd been to therapists and I had a probation officer and I've sat in front of judges and I've been to counselors. Nobody's ever said those words. I didn't know what they were. So I'm in rehab. I'm going to stop right here for a second, though, because I want to talk about this for just a minute. As I mentioned, my family about kind of half of us being alcoholics. I love Pioneers. As I said, this is my home group where I come on Wednesday nights, but I especially love Pioneers because our nephew went through here in 2020. I have a nephew who didn't see the light of day for like 20 years. He was a heroin addict from the age of 17. And in 2020, I was at a family party and he was there. It was on March 1st, 2020. And he said, and he'd been to some rehabs and had, I don't know, maybe sobriety before, I don't know how sober, but on this day at this party I was at one of our family members, he said, I have 30 days, but he looked real sketchy and real nervous. And I had that feeling, you know where you have that feeling like you've got someone, like I got you here. And I said, come down to San Diego. Let me and Uncle John get you into a program. I have a place. I didn't know if Pioneers would take him, but I said, I have a place. And like 2 weeks later, he was here in the house. And John and I went and visited him the day after Thanksgiving. He's got 4 years clean and sober. He got married last year to a woman who has 5 years clean and sober. They had Christmas lights outside their house. He has a beautiful life, and it started here at Pioneers. And like I said, this is someone who lived in my sister's car, who didn't see the outdoors for many years. It was here he got out to the beach and learned how to surf. I'm so grateful for pioneers giving him a start. And if you have any family members that suffer from the disease, it is so painful and frustrating and terrible. It's like painful to watch. And then the opposite side is to watch someone get sober, because we've got a few family members, a few of my nieces and nephews are sober now. There's nothing more spectacular than to see that. So I wanted to say that. So I go to rehab, and, you know, I have this Halloween tradition of frying on acid and going to see Oingo Boingo with all my friends. We do that every year. And that was coming up. This was in October of 1986. I'm in rehab. And I want to get out and do my Halloween tradition and then come back to rehab maybe in November. And nobody goes for this there. The counselors, nothing, right? You got to do it right now, and there's going to be holidays, and there's going to be important things, and we stay sober through it all. And so I stay there. And I don't know on what day I'm there, they take us to an AA meeting. It's my first AA meeting ever. And this is what I will tell you about it. It was, felt kind of like this, what I remember of it. It was big. It was either in Glendale or Pasadena. A lot of people. A lot of loose laughter. A lot of hugging and yucking it up. And it was happy. I can't remember anything else. I don't remember if it was a speaker. I don't remember if it was a sharing meeting. But I remember the feeling I got in that meeting. I'll never forget it. I was so attracted to all of you. I was attracted to you. I was attracted to what you had. I wanted what you had. I wanted to have the life you had. I probably looked like some of the women that are there. I never thought I would get this old, that I'd be wearing Christmas earrings. Like, this is lame. But there, you know, there were women like that that looked, you know, clean. Their eyes were white. Like you said, maybe they're wearing holiday earrings. They looked normal, and they looked happy. And I was connected to AA from that point on. I did not stop drinking, but I was connected to AA from that point on, and connected to you from that point on. So, I got some sobriety. I was in rehab for a couple months and got out. And I don't know how long I was sober. 2 weeks, a week, 3 weeks. And I was walking down the street one bright sunny day, and up pulls a pickup truck, and it's my dealer. And he said, "You need a ride." And time stood still. And everything went through my head, right? Don't get in the car, don't get in the car, don't get in the car. And you're sober now, and you're in AA, and these people are going to help you. And I got in the car. I wouldn't find long-term sobriety for 3 more years, because, like I said, my sobriety date is October 12th of 1989, so it would take me 3 years. More time sober in those 3 years than not sober. When I got out, so I went to rehab in Glendale, and I went back to Oxnard, California, and I got a directory, an AA directory of meetings, right? You know, the books. And found a meeting to go to that was at the Wagon Wheel Alano Club. That whole area, that whole sketchy, skeevy area, perfect place for an AA club. It was there, I didn't know. It was across the street from the trailer I was living in. You wouldn't know it. It was a weird industrial-like building. There was a door, and the only thing defining on it was there was a circle and a triangle on the door. This place saved my life. My husband likes to tell this story about dying and going to heaven, and it was on Buckaroo Street that if he dies and goes to heaven, it'll be Buckaroo Street, the entrance into heaven. So I started going to the Wagon Wheel Alano Club. My home group was the 5:30 Happy Hour. It still exists. It's now in Camarillo, and because it's changed locations, it's now at this place called The Buck, which is a place just for meetings, and they've hung on to kind of the origins because it was on Buckaroo Street. I have been so well taken care of and so well loved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I was a fair-weathered AA. I went to meetings. I did social activities with people in AA. I ran, you know, I kind of did the sponsor wheel, you know, get a sponsor. They'd let me go, get another one. I wouldn't work the steps. Like I said, a fair weather AA, a mooch, for lack of a better word. And people just loved me. This Solano Club, there was a missing persons report out for me, so the police went there. My dope fiend heroin addict brother decided he was going to try to help me out one time, went there looking for me. I mean, I was kind of a nuisance as well, right? I mean, this is the kind of things that I was attracting there. And I was always welcomed back. Super well-loved, well-taken care of. I loved these people. Loved them. So I'm sober a bit, and in between there's just a lot more stuff that a lot more garbage, right? Just garbage. I'm arrested more. I finally go to jail. My family's horrified because only my brothers go to jail. I'm the baby, you know, the baby girl's going to jail. Yes, I am. I was actually looking forward to it. I thought I can get a little head start on sobriety, is what I thought in my mind. Yeah, I'll get a little head start and come out and maybe be able to get sober. I didn't. I got out and I drank. I'm an alcoholic because I do not have control over my liquor consumption once I start to drink. If you are new, I will tell you that it's not a secret. It's here in the big book what we believe. What we believe here is that I have an allergy. It's a physical allergy. I have the allergy right this second. It's not going anywhere. If I put alcohol into my body, the way that allergy is activated is I am condemned to drink more until I kill myself, kill you. Somebody steps in like the police to stop me. I can't stop on my own. That is why I'm an alcoholic. All the other stuff, oh, I'm selfish, oh, I'm crazy. Okay, whatever. That's not part of alcoholism. What I've just described is part of alcoholism. The other stuff, we've all got kind of our crazy. The steps do a great job on that as well. But what's really guaranteed in the steps is that I will be put in this position that I explained at the beginning. I'm stoked to be sober. I don't want to drink. I've taken those steps. What is promised in the 10th step has happened for me. I am in a place of neutrality where alcohol is concerned. Neutrality. I'm not thinking about drinking or not drinking. I'm not living a tortured existence or wishing it was different. I don't wish it was different. I don't. So let's see. It must have been 8, 9, 10, 11. October 8th, 1989, I decide to drink. I decide to drink because my boyfriend, who I've been with for a couple years, cannot stay sober. I met him in an AA dance. Not an AA dance, a sober dance at an Alano club. And he had 9 months at the time because he just got out of jail from serving 9 months. And we hit it off and we were together and I was trying to stay sober for the both of us. If ever you've done that, you know how hideous that is. He could not stay sober. So on October 8th, I just decided, F this. Why am I putting off the inevitable? I'm going to drink. Because I can't stay sober anyways. It's always coming. The drink is always coming. So I drink with my boyfriend, drink for 4 days. I'd had some sobriety, so I actually had a job. So if you ever hear the terms, again, new people, you'll hear the terms functioning alcoholic or non-functioning alcoholic. All that means is if you're a functioning alcoholic, you can get to work. You can hold down a job. That's all that means. So I'm a non-functioning alcoholic. I can't hold down a job. So immediately that night when I'm drinking, I think, let me do the responsible thing. I call my work. I say, I quit. I'm drunk. I'm never going to come in again. Give them the heads up that I'm not going to be there the next day. And, you know, I'm drinking cough syrup. You know, when they used to make it with the good ingredients, you'd Robitussin. Remember that? Yeah, you get paralyzed. You can't move off that stuff. I'm drinking Robitussin. And then on the fourth night, I get into a physical altercation with my boyfriend in the middle of the street. And he's winning. And we're causing a scene because people are coming outside. Neighbors are coming outside. An ambulance is coming. The police is coming. I lost the fight. My head is split open. I get taken to the emergency room. And not my worst night drinking. That's not my worst night drinking. I've had worse. There was nothing so spectacularly bad about this night that I thought I'm going to get sober forever. Nothing. I go to the ER, get, you know, suit my head suit shirt up, and I'm drunk dialing from the hospital apparently because people show up. My mom shows up. I guess I drunk dialed her. My sponsor, I had a sponsor because I was sober at the time. My sponsor Paige shows up. She has a newcomer in tow to come look at the wreckage of the alcoholic's presence. Humiliating. I was so mad. Irene, she was a fair weather day like me. She couldn't stay sober. I told Paige, you're going to be bringing me to see Irene next time in the hospital. I was so obnoxious. Obnoxious, ungrateful, selfish, disgusting. And you know what that sponsor did? She took me home to her house. She took me home to her house. We got up the next morning, and we sat at the kitchen table, and we read the big book. She'd sat me at that kitchen table a lot and read the big book to me. And you know what? It wasn't working. I was not getting sobriety. It wasn't working. So I thought, here we go again. I'm going to drink, or I'm going to really do the what is going to work for me, which is to kill myself. And I spent a lot of new sobriety with my brain just going in circles of, am I going to drink? Am I going to stay sober? I should kill myself. Am I going to drink today? Am I going to stay sober? I need to kill myself. That was my early months of sobriety. And I just went back to AA because what else was I going to do? Where else did I have to go? I was well loved and well taken care of in AA. I came back to AA and people were happy to see me. Happy I was sober, happy I was alive. If you have relapsed or you've relapsed recently and you feel ashamed and embarrassed and like you've let us down, you're not sure you can stay sober, you're wasting our time, what do we think of you? That's all you. We don't feel that way about you at all. We are happy you're sober. We're happy you're alive. We're happy you're here. And we want to do everything we can to help you stay sober. That's the reality. So I maintain my fair-weathered AA status. And I'm going to shoot forward a little bit because I do stay sober. I'm sober. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing social stuff. And I'm still running through sponsors because I'm not working the steps and I'm unwilling. So sponsors don't sponsor me for long. Now my boyfriend is my fiance, and he's in prison. And I'm a year sober, and I'm traveling up north to visit him. You go to visitation on weekends, and I'm thinking, I've got to get my shit together, just like when I was drinking. I've got to get my shit together. And I've got a little crew in AA. You know, there's a lot of young people in AA, and one of those people in kind of my circle was John, and we were friends, and, fast forward, he's my husband now. So John and I were really good friends. We used to go to meetings together. We hung out in the same group, And I mean, we fell madly into lust with each other. I mean, really, yeah. And I moved in immediately, like on day two. And I wasn't broken up with the fiance yet. So I'm living with John. He knows my fiance. He knows, and he knows I'm going up on weekends for visitation and this is how I lived. I brought all my crazy into AA with me. That didn't go away for a long time. I've said this before. I started getting a whole bunch of credit cards because I was sober. I was working. I was, like, responsible. I was charging up. Then I just write deceased on the bills and mail it back. That does not work. Don't try that. Doesn't work. They find out you're alive. So John's kind of nuts too. He's sober 2 years more than me, but he ain't got it all together either. So we're just kind of living by the seat of our pants. I break it off with the fiance, and I was somewhere around probably getting very close to 2 years sober, and two really important things happened to me. The first thing is, there was this meeting at the Camarillo State Hospital, which is no longer there now. It's University of California, Channel Islands. But there used to be a state mental hospital. And how fitting that there was this meeting there called What Does the Big Book Say? And we'd heard about this. This meeting was like the scary meeting. All the old timers went there. There was all these stories about this meeting. You couldn't share unless you, like, had studied the big book, and there was no personal experience, and all these, like, long old-timers, right? All these old-timers went there. And I decided to go check out this meeting. And if ever you've had a meeting change your life, you know what this feels like. Because this meeting changed my life. On that night that I went into that meeting, my life was changed. I went to that meeting and it was true. You couldn't share any personal experience. You could only talk about the big book. And you didn't even read the big book in order. It was so weird. You studied it by topics and you would go home. There was no silkworth.org. You couldn't look this up and cheat. You just had to go through the book and whatever topic we were on, you'd have to find what you could about it. And then we would go back and we would share about it. You could only share about it if you did your homework. And I fell in love with this meeting. People were like in love with the big book and were talking about it in a way that like it sparked something in me. I wanted to know more. I didn't know what was the Mayflower Hotel? What were they talking about that Bill was at the Mayflower Hotel making some phone call? I didn't know what that was about because I wasn't reading the big book. I did not know that, you know, one of the most important figures in AA was a non-alcoholic named Dr. William Silkworth, who has a couple letters in the Roman numerals. I didn't read the Roman numerals. That doesn't count, right? You start at page one. I didn't know that. So I never read the family afterward because I felt like my family was a loss. They're not going to forgive me. Why am I going to read the family afterward, right? Which is a very good and relevant chapter. I love that today. So, yeah, this meeting did it for me. I was like, I'm going to start learning about the big book. I want to be one of these big book thumpers. But another important thing was that the secretary was a guy named Lyle. I got sober with him. We had the same amount of time. And Lyle was smoking me as far as knowledge went about AA and the big book. And he was secretary of this meeting. So I also felt embarrassed and jealous. And I kind of saw what I was for the first time. I kind of saw that I am a taker in AA. I'm a taker. I wasn't concerned about giving anything back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was only concerned about me. What can you do for me? How can I feel better? I'm not happy. This sobriety thing is not working out for me. Me, 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 my only concern. So I start going to this big book study, and then I go to this speaker meeting, and this woman named Maureen speaks. And Maureen was like, I just fell in love with her. If you've ever fallen in love, like maybe you have a sponsor that you really love, I fell in love with her that night. When she talked from the podium, she was crazy in sobriety too for like her first 17 years. Or 14 years, but when I heard her speak, she was on the other side of that. She was sponsoring women. She was acting like a sane lady. She was hardcore. And I thought what a lot of us think, which is not true. I thought, this woman's going to fix me. I'm going to go ask her to sponsor me because she's the one that can fix me. That doesn't happen here. We subscribe to the blind leading the blind. Like, okay, I used to be drunk. Now I'm not. Let me share it with you. There's not... Nobody's fixing anybody here, you know? But she started sponsoring me, and she was serious. Maureen, my husband calls her a force. She was like a force. She sponsored me for so long, she practically sponsored John. I mean, she started sponsoring me. I think we'd been together a couple months. She would freely share her opinions with you. She would freely talk to you about the traditions. And I know some of you maybe in this room, I've talked to you about the traditions before. But she's told me, like, if you stay sober, you're going to take some arrows in the back. Don't back down. You stand up for the steps and you stand up for the traditions. This is what's going to save us. So I believe strongly in that. And I do abide by the traditions. That is what is collectively going to keep AA. I want AA to be here when I'm dead and gone, you know, and that's what's going to keep us alive. So I don't screw around with the traditions either. I'm not going to talk about different books that I read. I'm not going to talk about where I stand politically or what I think about medication. I'm not going to post my picture anywhere. And if you take my picture, I'm going to ask you not to do that again. If it's anywhere near any sort of a sober, get together. Anyways, so Maureen, I was scared of her also. I loved her and I didn't want to lose her. So everything she asked me to do, I did. Because she was strong. She was kind of scary too. She was like a mom and a cheerleader, but also a parole officer and a comedian and a, I don't know. She was all of it in together. So I worked the steps with her. Yeah, we worked the steps, and someone asked me to sponsor them, and I was scared to death, and because I wasn't through my steps yet, and I said, well, I got to ask my sponsor because I'm not quite through with my amends. And I asked Maureen, you know, this woman asked me to sponsor, and she said, well, did you say yes? And I said, well, no, I told her I'd talk to my sponsor, because inherently I was really hoping my sponsor would say, no, you're not ready to sponsor. But she said, yes, you sponsor. This is going to keep you staying ahead because you're not all done yet. So I started sponsoring, and it's freaky. That's another thing. If you stay sober here, you're going to get asked to sponsor. There's nothing we can do to keep someone sober, and there's nothing we can do to get someone drunk. None of that. I know that I'm armed with a solution. I used to be a drinking alcoholic. I am not. And I know the way out, which is through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can do that with another person. So I do that. I do that freely. Working with others, the first sentence, so important. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from alcohol as intensive work with other alcoholics. I'll tell you the words that stand out to me. Nothing. Nothing will so much ensure immunity. That's what I'm going for, immunity. Intensive. I'm not some fair-weathered sponsor. I mean, the women I sponsor know. Lisa's here. I sponsor you your first year. You're calling me every day. I'm answering that phone and we're talking. It might only be for a couple minutes, but I'm not a tech sponsor. We are talking on the phone. We are going to get to know each other. And the next sentence after that says, it works when other activities fail. It does. There's been times, I mean, I've been sober a long time. Shit has happened. My dad died. Brutal manner. ICU. It was like a horror show. It was terrible. He came to my mom's house to die, and everyone was flipped out about taking care of him, so they gave me the liquid Dilaudid and said, you're dosing him. We're scared to do this, you know? And I did that. And then I wrote the obituary because nobody could do it. Everyone was scared. They know how to write an obituary. I don't know how to write an obituary. But I had help in AA. I had help where, you know what somebody said? They said, let's read some obituaries to get some ideas. That's what we did. Where was I? I was talking about shit has hit the fan. Yes. So losing my dad, both my brothers. I got two sisters that are non-alcoholic and they're alive and well. And then I got my two brothers who are alcoholic like me, and they are both dead from the disease. My most favorite brother died at 42, drank himself to death. And if you think you can drink and get lucky and die like that in a car accident, it might not happen that way. And watching somebody drink themselves to death is really incredibly gory. It took him a couple years, a lot of hospital stays, a lot of blood. And then my other brother was a junkie and he died at 55. So, and then there's just been, you know, there's lows to life, you know? And I can tell you that through all of that, I have always sponsored. I know how important that is. And I will tell you that when Maureen, you know, in October of 2021, they found brain tumors. That this is what did her in. She'd survived lung cancer 3 times, but she got brain tumors. And it seemed like they were kind of fading. They were giving her radiation. They were getting smaller. And then in June of 2022, she went into hospice. Here's what I learned about sponsorship. She was completely functioning, but she couldn't physically walk anymore. So she was in a hospital bed, but she had all her faculties about her. She could talk on the phone. People were constantly in and out. Her home health care nurses had commented, like, who are all these people? You have way too many visitors. So I was going and taking care of her with a bunch of other people in AA, you know, constantly. And it must have been in July. It was very soon after she was in hospice. I went in, we were talking, and she said, oh, I just started sponsoring this woman in Florida that I met on a Zoom meeting. And my sponsor was in hospice care at this point. And in my mind, I thought, like this is your time to get a break. I didn't think that she couldn't do it, because I know she could do it till she died, but like, this is your reason. You've got the solid excuse to back away and not do this anymore. That's not what she did. She did it till the end. When she was unable to really even do Zoom anymore. They started a meeting at our house on Sunday afternoons. So very fittingly, September 11th was a Sunday, and there was a meeting at her house. She was not able to speak at that point, and that night she died. So that's my example. That's my example for giving back. So yes, shit has hit the fan, and I've always sponsored through it. And if you, let me tell you one thing, if you are new or you are concerned, you have a sponsor who is going through it, that their spouse is dead, their kid is dead, they've lost their job, they're losing their house, I don't care what it is, call your sponsor. Don't think that they are too busy or have so much going on that they don't need to hear from you. They need to hear from you. I know Maureen needed to hear from me when she was sick. She needed to listen to my petty crap and give to me. She still was in AA. She needed to get out of self and work with others. And the times where I've had things going on in my life, thank God I've always had sponsees who could call me and I could get out, get my beady little eyes off my life and give to someone else. There's a million other things I could say, but I'm going to end with Bill's words. Because Bill Wilson, what a great pontificator and writer. You know, in a lot of Bill's writings, he uses the word bond and bonded, being bonded to each other. I said something like that. Connected, I think, is the word I used when I first went to an AA meeting. You know, that I'm connected to you. I'm bonded to you, just the way Bill uses that word. It's not my choice. It's just the way it is. So I'm going to read this little thing. It's out of Three Talks to Medical Societies, and it's Bill giving a talk to a medical society, but he's talking about meeting Ebby when Ebby brings the solution of sobriety to him. And here's what Bill says. At first, my friend's story generated mixed emotions. I was drawn and revolted by turns. My solitary drinking went on for some weeks, but I could not forget his visit. Several themes coursed in my mind. First, that his evident state of release was strangely and immensely convincing. Second, that he had been pronounced hopeless by competent doctors. Third, that these age-old precepts, when transmitted by him, struck me with great power. Fourth, that I could not and would not go along with any God concept, that there would be no conversion nonsense for me. Often trying to divert my thoughts, I found it no use. By cords of understanding, suffering, and simple verity, another alcoholic had bound me to him. I could not break away. And that is the way I feel about all of you. You have bound yourselves to me. I cannot break away. And you know what? I don't want to. Thanks.